She said, I don't know, you know, my marriage is like being roommates. I have a kind of a cordial relationship with my adult children. She said that my work is not interesting to me anymore. I'm not making progress. My decision-making isn't so crisp. I see my younger colleagues who work for me questioning my decisions at this point. She said, I'm getting bad reports from my doctor. I think I'm drinking too much. I don't exercise. What do I do, professor? I said, you don't need to come to me. You told me. Take a souvenir in your firm and step back and let somebody else run it. Go away with your husband. Get some counseling together if you need it. Reacquaint yourself with your children. Get into the gym. Get your drinking under control. What do you want me to tell you? Why don't you do that? You know the answer. And she said, I know. I guess I'd prefer to be special than happy. Is that you? Have you chosen specialness over happiness ever?
Hi, everyone. I'm Celeste Headlee. Welcome to Women Amplified from the Conferences for Women. You just heard from Harvard professor Arthur Brooks, joining us today to talk about his book, From Strength to Strength, Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in the Second Half of Life. Many of us assume that the more successful we are, the less susceptible we'll be to that sense of irrelevance that often comes with aging, both professionally and socially. But the truth is, the greater our achievements and our attachment to them, the more we notice our decline and the more painful it is when it occurs. So what can we do starting now to make our older years a time of happiness and purpose and success? Arthur Brooks will tell you how to do just that and create your very own happiness 401k plan in this episode, which is an encore replay from a 2022 Pennsylvania Conference for Women breakout session. And by the way, this year's Pennsylvania conference is now completely sold out, as is the Texas conference. But you can still snag tickets to the Massachusetts Conference for Women in December, and soon to the California Conference for Women in February. So to learn more, go to conferencesforwomen.org. Now, I'm so excited to hear more from our guest, so let's get started.
Think of what I'm going to talk about today as your happiness 401k plan. You don't start that, if you can, when you're 65 or 75. You start that when you're younger. I want to talk to you about the investments that you can make that will virtually guarantee that you can be happier at 75 than you were at 25 and get happier all along the way. So this is what we're going to be talking about today, the investments in you and the investments in the people that you love as part of this new book that I've written, which I've written for you. And actually for me too. I started this book about 8 years ago as a research project for myself. I wasn't even intending to publish it as a book. What happened was I had this experience some years ago. I used to be the president of a think tank. That's a research organization. It was in Washington, D.C. And I had hundreds of employees. It was kind of an interesting and pretty high-pressure job. I would travel around giving speeches, and I had to raise a lot of money based on philanthropy. It was kind of like running for the Senate and never getting elected, which maybe doesn't sound like that much fun, but had some really good times. But I have to tell you that about halfway through, when I was turning 50 or so, I started wondering, you know, what's the future hold for me? What's the end game of this? What am I trying to do so that when this thing ends, I'm happy and I'm ready for this thing to end? Now, that's not all about being an executive or somebody who's successful in a worldly way. All of us have these questions. We have these questions, whether we're raising our children, whether we're going to work someplace else. We want to know what the trajectory is so that we can get happier. Well, I was kind of tortured by this. I was having kind of a crisis, I have to admit. And one night when I was thinking about this, I was just turning about 50. I was on an airplane. I was always on an airplane, it seemed like. And I was actually flying back from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. It was nighttime. It was dark. Most people were sleeping or, you know, looking at the movie. But I was tapping away on my laptop. Well, I started to hear a conversation behind me, the row behind me on the airplane. Now, I'm a social scientist. My job is studying behavior. So my laboratory, well, it's the overheard conversation. If you're behind me in the line at Starbucks and you're telling somebody that somebody has broken your heart, keep your voice down because, you know, I might write a book about it. Anyway, I was hearing a conversation behind me on the plane, not trying to eavesdrop, of course, but I couldn't help it. You'll see in a minute why. It was obviously a man and a woman. I could tell by their voices that they were quite elderly. And I figured they were married. because I couldn't quite make out the husband's words, but the wife's voice was very distinct. And she was saying, don't say it would be better if you were dead to her husband. Wow. I mean, that's pretty heavy. So the more I listened, the more I realized that he was really disconsolate. And he was pouring out his heart about how he felt like his best days were behind him and nobody cared about him anymore. And I started thinking to myself, well, this is somebody who's obviously, you know, pretty disappointed. We land in Washington, D.C., and everybody stands up and the lights turn on, and I'm kind of curious. So I turn around to get a look, and it's one of the most famous men in the world. This is somebody that we all know. This is a hero, rich and famous, not controversial. This is somebody we all admire. And I heard him just confessing to his wife that he felt he might as well be dead. Now, this blew my mind. So I thought to myself, this is not the model that the world tells you. The world tells you to be happy, you need to be successful, working hard, getting the rewards, banking it, dying happy. That's what the world tells you. But that's not right, is it? There's more to it than that. I thought to myself, well, given the fact that I'm trying to figure out the rest of my own life, I'm never going to be the hero on the plane, don't get me wrong. But maybe, just maybe, there are more similarities than I like to admit. And maybe I can do things better. What can I do when I was 50 at the time? I'm 58 today. Still making these investments that I can do to get happier. Well, I undertook a big study of my own life, of the behavior of myself. This was not research, it was me search, but I was looking at vast amounts of neuroscience and social science and the science of happiness as people age. What are the patterns? What are the habits of the people who wind up happy? And I found the answer. I think I cracked the code, and I'm going to share it with you now. Now, where does the study start? Where does any study start for a guy like me? And the answer is with the data on what's really going on, kind of the level set. What's the ordinary set of circumstances? How do people generally age with respect to happiness? Do most people get happier as they get older, or do they get unhappier as they get older? So I looked at the best data set that I could find. It comes from these two economists, one in England and one who teaches at Dartmouth here in the United States. And we have data from all over the world. This is data from India and data from sub-Saharan Africa. We have data from China and from the United States and Europe and every place else in between. So I was looking at all these big data sets on how people get happier or unhappier as they get older. And the results really surprised me. So to begin with, I was looking at a data set of about 500,000 Americans and British citizens. And it was the opposite of what I thought. You know, when I ask my students, they're all about 27 years old, they're getting their MBA at the Harvard Business School. Do you think you're gonna be happier or unhappier in 10 years when you're, say, 37 years old? They all think they're gonna be happier. They say happier. Now, that makes sense. They're optimists, right? They wouldn't be going into that much debt if they weren't optimists, obviously. So I say, why? Why do you think you're gonna be happier at 37 than 27? And they talk about circumstances. They say, well, my student loans will be paid off, obviously. I'll have a good job that pays a lot of money. I think I'll be married to my soulmate, whoever that happens to be, et cetera. And that's going to be great. Those things are going to bring me happiness. I say, okay, that's plausible. Now think, 47, 10 years after that, happier or unhappier? And most of them say, I think I'll be a little happier still because all those good things will continue to be going in the right direction. Then I say, what about 77? And they all say, oh, I don't want that. Then why not? What's wrong with 77? And they can't give me an answer. Like, I don't know. It just doesn't sound like fun to be older. Got it. I say, okay, so what you're telling me is that you're 27 now and your happiness is going to go up and up and up and up and up. And after a while, it's going to max out. Then it's going to start to go back down again. I say, yeah, I guess that's what I'm saying. I say, okay, that's what seems right to me too, but let's look at the data. And I show them the data. And the data are the opposite of that. Here's what ordinarily happens. People, they tend to get slightly unhappier from their early 20s until their early 50s. It's not a lot. It's not catastrophic. It's just a little diminution of their happiness year after year after year. And there are a few reasons for this. Now, the first reason is just disappointment. I mean, a lot of people, I mean, everybody thinks they're going to get happier because their circumstances are going to get better. And their circumstances do get better. For all of my students and for most of you, I mean, your material circumstances did get better and your family life did get better from 27 to 37. It turns out, however, that that doesn't actually bring the happiness that they thought. More on that in a second. But that's really important because that disappointment that you got what you wanted, you got your heart's desire and it wasn't as great as you thought, well, that actually paradoxically becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy and brings your happiness down. The second big reason is kind of what we call let's just say euphemistically, family difficulties. And this is secret code for teenage kids. I don't have to convince a lot of you who have teenage kids. I mean, my kids are grown up now. They're in their 20s. But not that long ago, I had three teenagers. And let me tell you, it was no walk in the park. I remember at one point, I was on my happiness curve, really going down. It was in my late 40s. And my middle son, his name is Carlos. He's quite a character. And he was just running us through the ringer every day. We had a frequent flyer program at the principal's office, practically. And, you know, it's like, Carlos is getting a D in math. He might not graduate from history. Who knows if he's going to have, he's going to be able to graduate on. It was his grades. It was his grades again and again. And it, not living up to his potential. He's a smart kid, but he's not passing his classes. Finally, my wife, who's an optimist, she says, at least we know he's not cheating. You know, I mean, I was not at the high point of my happiness curve, and neither was my wife. Okay, that bottoms out in your low 50s. Then the data show on, and this is, again, people all over the world. There's no sleight of hand here. Then it starts to increase, and almost everybody increases from their early 50s until their late 60s or 70, as a matter of fact. And it's unbelievable, as a matter of fact. Only two groups don't get this. People who are addicted to drugs and alcohol or have unremediated mental illness. But almost everybody else gets happier during that period, which is great. But then a weird thing happens around age 70. It looks like there's this shelf in the data. It looks like people stay constant all the way to the end. Okay, so what's going on with that? What's going on with that shelf in the data? You look a little bit more carefully, and it turns out that that's where the action is. It's what it looks like when you have the average happiness across the population and it stays steady, what's really happening is the population is breaking up into two equal-sized groups. Half the population after age 70 gets happier and happier and happier all the way to the end. And the other half starts getting unhappier and gets unhappier all the way to the end. And they average out to no change. Now, that's a big difference, isn't it? And I'm just going to take a wild guess, friends, that I know which group you want to be in. You want to be on the upper branch and you want to be on that lower branch. And this is the key happiness research question for this book and for my life. How to get on the upper branch. That becomes the challenge. Now, here's the big weird problem. I always thought my whole life that the people who get on the upper branch are the most successful people, and the people who are on the lower branch are the most unsuccessful people. And that turns out to be the opposite of the truth. Let me give you what I call the striver's curse. To begin with, I have data from psychologists at the University of Texas at Austin who look at what they call the burden of high achievement. And it shows that the people who are identified as super achievers, hard workers, straight A's before they're 20, those are the people most likely to be disappointed about their lives after 80. You're thinking, well, that's crazy. How could that be? Well, it actually kind of makes sense. If you are objectified as the super achiever, as the hard worker, as the perfect student, I know who you are, because that was me too. It's hard to live up to that. It's almost impossible. If you're being told by your parents that you're number one, then you're going to be trying to be number one. There's only one number one. Everybody else isn't number one. And everybody else who isn't, who's dedicated to it, feels like they lost. And that's the reason that we have the burden of high achievement. That's number one. For the striver's curse, the strivers tend to be on the lower branch after 70. The second reason is what we call the law of psychoprofessional gravitation. Now, forget all that gobbledygook. I just actually made that up. Here's what that means. The more you succeed, the more it hurts when you're not successful anymore. You know, the higher you go, the further you fall. Look, if you never do anything with your life, you won't know when it's over. But if you do a lot, when it inevitably stops, it's going to hurt a lot. Those are the two reasons that strivers, fellow strivers, usually wind up on the bottom branch of the curve. So this is my real research now. How can you be successful early on, serious about your work, really dedicated to succeeding? That is to say, all of you, and be on the upper branch. Is it possible? The answer is absolutely yes, but you can't leave it up to chance. Here's a key thing I want you to understand. Mother Nature doesn't care if you're happy. Mother Nature wants you to be successful and pass on your genes. That's it. You want to be happy? That's your responsibility. And that means going against a lot of your natural inclinations. And that's a lot about what I'm going to talk about. What I'm going to tell you about are the habits of the hardest working, most successful people who wind up happy. What do they all do? And the answer is some stuff that doesn't come naturally, but that you can do.
You're listening to Arthur Brooks, Harvard professor, Atlantic columnist, and number one best-selling author of From Strength to Strength, Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in the Second Half of Life. If you love this podcast, please rate and review it. Your recommendation helps more women just like you hear from incredible Conference for Women speakers all year at no cost. And if you need a little more inspiration, a few more great tips, head on over to conferencesforwomen.org and click that subscribe button. Our monthly newsletters are filled with wisdom, insights, inspiration that can help you succeed at work and at life. That's conferencesforwomen.org/subscribe. Now, let's get back to Arthur.
Okay, now number one is this. They understand that being successful means different things at different times in your life. You know, when you're early on, when you get your 10,000 hours of practice, when you're working really, really hard, you're getting better at what you do, that can mean a lot of different things. Maybe you're an accountant, maybe you're a lawyer, maybe you're a cellist in a symphony orchestra, maybe you're becoming a better and better parent. You're getting better at it during your 20s and 30s, and you can see the trajectory of progress, and it's intensely pleasurable. I mean, it's really, really good. But what we find is in almost every profession that as people get better in their 20s and 30s, they tend to peak in their capacity, and then they tend to decline. Now, this is part of what the great British psychologist Raymond Cattell called fluid intelligence. Fluid intelligence is your working memory, your ability to focus, your innovative capacity. It makes you good at what you do when you practice more and more as a young adult. That fluid intelligence has to do with the structure of the brain, and it peaks weirdly around age 39. I've looked at it for stockbrokers and doctors. I've looked at it for air traffic controllers and electricians and musicians and lawyers and everything. It turns out that Nobel Prize winning scientists, the average age when they did their work to win the prize, they get the prize way later, but they did the work at age 39, and then it drops off. They all see a degradation. Now, they see it, but nobody else does. And some of you know what I'm talking about here. Some of you know exactly that you're mid-40s and you're starting to feel a little burned out. The reason is because you don't feel like you're making progress anymore. You know how your dentist, about age 43, started taking Fridays off to go golfing? This wasn't because your dentist was making a lot more money. It's because your dentist suddenly started liking being a dentist less. And the reason for that was she or he was making less progress in the dentist game. Now, you couldn't see it. He wasn't drilling the wrong tooth, for Pete's sake. But she could see it. She wasn't getting better as a dentist. And that's just no fun. That's the reason, the primary reason for burnout in your 40s, from your job, becoming less passionate about what you do. And a lot of people consider that to be just an unmitigated disaster. When people start to experience that, you know, they'll try harder, they'll ride their skill curve down, their fluid intelligence curve, they'll become fearful, they'll become bitter, they'll become angry. You've seen it, I've seen it, we've seen it 1,000 times. But the problem with that is that what that does is it marries you to information that's incomplete. Raymond Cattell, the guy who came up with the fluid intelligence curve, he also noticed in his data that that's not the only intelligence curve. There's a second intelligence curve that while your first one's falling through your 40s and 50s and 60s, the second intelligence curve is rising during your 40s and 50s and 60s, and it gets higher in your 70s, and it stays high for the rest of your life. But it's a different set of skills. That's called your crystallized intelligence curve, and it's not based on your working memory. It's never going to be the same as what it was. And part of the reason for that is not because there's something wrong with your brain. It's because your library of knowledge and memories is huge. And so it needs a filing system. It takes a long time to send your little librarian to go back to the stacks and take the elevator up to the 9th floor and to get that name of that guy who's standing right in front of you. Your brain is full, quite literally. This is what neuroscientists are finding increasingly, that the amount of knowledge is so vast, it's hard to access it. The working memory is lower, for sure. Innovative capacity, the ability to solve problems faster than everybody else, that's lower. Your ability to focus intently for the same period of time, that's lower. But here's the good news. Your wisdom is higher. That means that you're able to use information to synthesize ideas, to tell stories, to describe stuff, to recognize patterns, to teach people, to lead people, to mentor. That gets better and better and better. Here's the deal, folks. Here's what you need to do. You got to step from that fluid intelligence curve onto your crystallized intelligence curve. Now, what does that mean for you? If you're a lawyer, you're a star litigator on your fluid intelligence curve. You're the managing partner on your crystallized intelligence curve. Don't try to stay on the first one. If you're an entrepreneur, you do your startup on your fluid intelligence curve, and you're a venture capitalist recognizing the next big idea in your crystallized intelligence curve. If you're a teacher like me, you do your big research ideas, your math and your technical stuff and your big ideas early on, and you impart these ideas like I'm doing right now when you're older, because you're better at it. You have a better vocabulary. You have a better way to understand, to get inside the heads of the people who are watching so that they can understand you very, very clearly. Even if you're explaining complex ideas, you become a master teacher. What does it mean for you to get on your crystallized intelligence curve? Figure it out and go there. Don't get stuck. That's one of the first big secrets of people who wind up happier. Secret number two. Now, I'm only going to give you three of these secrets during this little talk. You got to read the book for the rest of them because I don't have time to do that right now. But they're all like this. Here's the second big one. People who wind up happy as they get older, they have a huge skill. It's not the skill of adding more and more to their life. It's the skill of taking things away. Now, when I was traveling, I mean, I traveled for all my adult life, but when I was traveling very intensively in Taiwan, I one time went to a museum, the world's largest and most extensive and magnificent museum of Chinese art and artifacts called the National Palace Museum of Taiwan. And I had this guide with me who was explaining why that Chinese art and Western art are different. And he said, you know, you in the West, your art starts from like an empty canvas that you fill up. It starts from nothing and it winds up with a full canvas. We think of a work of art as starting with a block of jade, and the art already exists inside, and we have to chip away the jade until we find the work of art. That's a very interesting distinction between the two. It's a very different metaphor. Then he said something that really blew my mind that expanded my consciousness a lot. He said, that's the same way that you think about your lives. In the West, you think about, I'm going to be successful when I have enough stuff, when I add more, 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 more. More successful means more adding. We think of life as becoming complete when we take things away until we find our true selves. Important, right? I don't have to decide which of those is right. The fluid intelligence curve is the adding curve. The crystallized intelligence curve is the taking away curve. If you are 40 years old or older, you need to start subtracting, the art of subtracting. Here's the deal, folks. Your satisfaction increasingly will not come from managing your haves. Your real satisfaction is what you have divided by what you want. And you all know that increasing the numerator is just one way to get a higher number. Decreasing the denominator is a more effective way of getting a higher number. Your satisfaction will go up not just when you get more of what you have, which is very ephemeral. It's evanescent. It's very temporary. What you need to do is to manage your wants. Let me put it a different way. You don't need to have more in the second half of life. You need to want less. And if you're not in the second half of life yet, start practicing wanting less. You don't need a bucket list. You need a reverse bucket list. Make a list of all your cravings and desires and then say, it's okay if I get these things, but here's my plan to detach my heart from getting these things. You will see your satisfaction rise. And that's what all happy people who've been enormously successful do in the second half of life. Now, third, and this is really one of the biggest ones as far as I'm concerned, is basically this. Successful people who are unhappy, they're lonely. They just are. You know, it's interesting, and I interviewed this enormously successful woman for the book. She's one of the titans of Wall Street. I mean, she started this incredible company, this financial services firm that was worth billions of dollars. She was worth billions of dollars. She was my age. Late 50s. And when I interviewed her, you know, when you study happiness, you know, I teach happiness at Harvard. They treat you like a psychiatrist, right? And she says, I'm not happy. And I said, what's wrong? She said, I don't know. You know, my marriage is like being roommates. I have a kind of a cordial relationship with my adult children. She said that my work is not interesting to me anymore. I'm not making progress. My decision-making isn't so crisp. I see my younger colleagues who work for me questioning my decisions at this point. Is that I'm getting bad reports from my doctor. I think I'm drinking too much. I don't exercise. What do I do, professor? I said, you don't need to come to me. You told me. take a souvenir in your firm and step back and let somebody else run it. Go away with your husband. Get some counseling together if you need it. Reacquaint yourself with your children. Get into the gym. Get your drinking under control. What do you want me to tell you? Why don't you do that? You know the answer. And she said, I know. I guess I'd prefer to be special than happy. Is that you? Have you chosen specialness over happiness ever? I have. You know, when she said that, it was like a knife to the heart. You know, I think of all those times when, as an executive, I chose my 14th hour at work over the first hour with my kids. I'm not proud of it, but I was trying to be special. I was trying to bank that next success. I was trying to close that next deal, whatever. And I'm not getting those years back. There's nothing that can bring those years back, but I can make progress now by recognizing that. And that's really all about reestablishing my relationships. What all successful, unhappy people later in life have in common is that they got nothing but deal friends, and they don't have any real friends, and that includes their spouse. I've done a lot of work on the most successful marriages, and the biggest element of a successful marriage is deep companionate love, aka close friendship. That is the big swinger in any relationship, but especially in marriage. And what I find is that successful strivers who are really unhappy, they got tons of deal friends and not so many real friends because they're alone. They see themselves as kind of the tree in the forest, like the lone aspen tree that has beautiful leaves. Well, you know, let me tell you something about the aspen tree that I actually didn't know because I'm not a botanist. I'm a social scientist. The aspen tree isn't a single plant. The aspen tree is actually one plant with many trees, the world's largest living organism, actually in the history of the planet Earth. It's called Pando. It's a stand of aspen trees in Utah, 106 acres, 6 million kilograms of wood. It looks like a lot of individual trees, hundreds, thousands, not one plant. You go to Aspen, Colorado on the Aspen Ideas Festival campus, one plant, all those aspen trees, one plant. Why do I make that metaphor? Because you think of yourself as a single individual, cultivating yourself, admiring your leaves, isolated, lonely perhaps, but solid. You can count on it. You can take shade under it because you're a striver, because you're successful, because you can be counted on. You're a respectable and dependable individual. Well, guess what? You're not one plant. Look to your left and look to your right. That's you. Your life is not counted up by the sum of your achievements. It's ultimately in your eulogy going to be counted as the sum of the relationships based on the love in your life. You need to spend less time on your leaves and more time on your roots as you get older. And if you're not older yet, the earlier you start, the better off it's going to be. So here's the basic ideas, my friends. Here's what I want you to remember. Number one is that your happiness is not going to take care of itself. You got to take care of it. It's not nature that's going to lead you to be happy as you get older. Maybe you get super lucky, but I wouldn't count on it. But number two, you can get happier if you have the right happiness hygiene and the right set of habits and the right set of disciplines, and you're willing to make some change and you're willing to work on it over the course of your adult life. You can master this. You can be happy. The first way to do this is to recognize that your skills, they're not static. They're not constant. They're going to change. You got to get from your first curve to your second curve. And that means figuring out what that second curve is and then having the courage to change. Maybe that's careers, maybe that's jobs, and maybe that's just changing the way you do your job, but you're going to have to make a change in the way that you live your life. The next is that you got to master the art of taking things away as opposed to adding. What are you going to do this year to take things away? What are you going to give away? What are you going to detach yourself from? By the way, you know what I did this year on my birthday, on my reverse bucket list? I gave away half of my political opinions because I want more love and friendship, and I wanted to be less weighed down by the attachments of my opinions. I'm telling you, it's the best thing I've ever done. Okay, the next lesson is you need to tend to your roots and not just your leaves, because your root system is the true you. And everything else is an illusion. And last but not least, never make the decision to be special over the decision to be happy. And to be happy really is a decision because it requires the skills I'm talking about today.
We hope you enjoy this episode with Arthur Brooks, Harvard professor, Atlantic columnist, and number one best-selling author of From Strength to Strength, Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in the Second Half of Life. To learn more about creating your happiness 401k plan, you can purchase his book with free shipping from the Conference for Women's online bookstore at conferencesforwomen.org. And to learn more about Arthur and his work, visit arthurbrooks.com. Thank you so much for spending your time with us today. The Conferences for Women is the largest network of women's conferences in the nation. They draw more than 55,000 women and men to annual events in Boston, Philadelphia, Austin, and California, and lately, online. I'm Celeste Headlee, and this is Women Amplified from the Conferences for Women. Thank you so much for listening. Be kind and be well.